Ciao a tutti. Hello, everyone. This is The Italian Job, a podcast that celebrates Italian wine and the characters that make the industry tick. I'm Paul Caputo, writer and critic, and on today's show, we're looking at how Italian wines are increasingly prominent in the world of fine wine investment. My guest today is James Miles of LiveX. We'll be talking about what underpins demand on the LiveX trading platform, and in particular, we'll cover the relentless surge in interest for Italian wines over the last decade or so. The conversation is not just about Sassicaia and Tignanello and Ornellaia and Masetto anymore. Instead, I think we can safely admit that many of those single vineyard cult status wines from Barbaresco and Barolo are firmly established in the upper echelons of the international fine wine market. I'm very excited to talk to James about this and to get his perspective on what the future might hold. There is obviously huge demand for the world's best wines, but with a recession on the horizon, a bewildered on-trade landscape, and a broadening of the investment market in general, working out exactly what the outlook is for speculators over the next few years is perhaps a little bit of a challenge. Beyond the investment side of things, this, I think, is really good for Italian wine in general. The fact that some of Italy's top estates can be considered on the same level as Bordeaux's first growths, an illustrious chateau, is a real watershed moment. Producers all over the country should be looking at this and noting that great terroir-focused wines can gain global recognition and appreciation. Right, let's get started with the show. Before we dive into my regular catch-up with Richard Siddle, though, I should mention that this podcast is made possible by The Buyer, so thank you very much to them. I really enjoy the news, insight, and opinion from their website, and if you're not signed up to the mailing list now, you really should do. Richard and Peter publish plenty of great content, and it is well worth reading and following. So, big thank you to them again. Very much value their support with this podcast. Okay, let's find out if Richard has been stockpiling cases of Super Tuscan under the stairs. Here he is.
Richard, hello. How are you?
Well, sir. Very good. Yeah, nice to see the sun's out again.
Indeed, it's absolutely scorching here.
So he's got his proverbial hat on, to say the least.
Indeed. In fact, it's a perfect day to enjoy English Wine Week with, isn't it? I've seen you've been putting out some propaganda on the old promotion tools.
Well, I had the privilege of speaking to Oz Clark for an hour and a half of the day, which is very, that was a bit of a treat, really, to be honest, in lockdown. Yeah, because, Oz is brilliant with his time. Every time you see Oz out and about in the trade, he's always happy to talk to you and stuff. But to actually spend a proper time chatting just one-on-one with him, and that was a real kind of like highlight for me. And his passion and love and knowledge and just sheer enthusiasm for English wine was something to behold, really. So that's available to watch on The Buyer, Chief. So anyone can go out there and click on and see the great Oz chatting away about English wine. But
are you a big fan of English wine?
I am, from the point of view that the real sheer growth has been over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, I guess, and also actually the number of independent wines that have really come through. So there's a lot more, I would call, the ones below the big six or eight that everyone normally talks about. I think that's really interesting. I think I won't lie. I mean, the price point of English sparkling wine means I'm not exactly quaffing it every week, Chief. But as and when Liverpool win the league, I might have a go and treat myself to a bottle, you know.
Indeed, well, I might deviate from that subject. It won't be the same with an asterisk on the trophy, of course. But
the number of wins I've had this season is more like obliques. So
fabulous. Okay, so you perhaps will be able to celebrate with an on-trade meal and a bottle of Italian wine. We've got the news that the 4th of July is the big day. Is that good? Is the trade excited about this, or are they a little bit nervous?
Perhaps a bit of both, but I think actually, to be honest, it's been such a build-up and anticipation and I think frustration in the trade. I think there's that kind of, it's almost the point where it was getting beyond a joke, really, to some extent, in terms of like how soon, you know, people got less than, well, since they made the announcement, it's even less than 2 weeks. And I think just the fact that they now have that date, they now have the flexibility to decide how they're going to reopen and what they're going to do. I think all the steps and measures that have been going on behind the scenes, I think it shows actually how much people have been planning to come back. I think what you probably see is pubs and perhaps some of the bigger casual dining chains with bigger outlets will be able to open up quite quickly. I think it's going to be more of a challenge for perhaps arguably, you know, the smaller neighbourhood and actually fine dining. I think fine dining might be harder because obviously a lot of fine dining is in central cities or central London in particular. You know, that's still very, very quiet. But I just saw actually Jason Atherton put out an email today saying that his restaurants are opening up early August and into September. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's definitely that kind of split, I suppose, between the kind of what you might call mainstream on-trade who are desperate to open straight away. And I think perhaps that more, you know, the kind of destination restaurant, the real cream restaurants may wait a little bit longer and tiptoe back into it. But I mean, it's just great for everybody. It's great for the producers. It's great for suppliers. It's great for everybody to get the whole wheel moving again. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that plays out. Obviously, the big scare is, you know, a second wave, and big fear is if people have to go into lockdown again, you know, that really could cause major, even bigger issues for the on-trade. So I think everybody should really have that in the back of their mind, and hopefully people will open and they'll make sure when they do that they really make sure that they follow the guidelines and ensure that the customer numbers are right. And I'm sure they will do, but the demand is likely to be very high in some places.
Yeah.
You know, so he's getting that balance right, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I've been obviously doing a little bit of work with Suave over the last week or so, and I know they're looking at arranging press trips. And one of the things that came out of that was they were hoping to get it in towards the end of September because they are anticipating another lockdown and another second wave. So it's interesting to see how some in Italy are approaching things. When we began this year, lots of people were making predictions about what might happen, and the global economy was a big topic on people's minds. We had the tariff situation potentially in America. We had a potential recession looming. No one could have predicted what has happened, but is recession now inevitable? Are we just floating into one over the next few weeks?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's actually really, I mean, obviously I'm not an economic expert at all, but listening to those who are, and it's not just going to be the UK, it's going to be a global situation again. And, you know, I mean, I suppose some countries will obviously be very different, but I think overall, there's going to be a massive pressure on jobs, and there's going to be a lot of people over the next 2-3 months who are unfortunately going to lose their jobs. And also, I think the problem then will be how quickly people can then find new jobs to go to. So yeah, I mean, we have to be realistic about it and say that it's not going to be. I mean, I know people have said things about, oh, this could be like the Roaring Twenties again, and we can like bounce all back again. I really don't think that's going to happen. I think this virus is going to be around for many months, and you know, that fear of the second wave, which we talked about, will put pressure on people. I mean, lots of research from people like Kantar and McKinsey and Brandwatch, the kind of guys who look at the sort of the consumer attitudes towards spending, and price and savings are the two big priorities. People are looking at saving more. You know, and also I think, you know, we have all actually kind of saved quite a lot of money over the last 2 or 3 months being in lockdown, and perhaps people will look at that opportunity to save a little bit more and protect themselves, because, you know, let's face it, none of us are going to be secure in our jobs over the next 6 months. So impact on wine and restaurants and the supply, well, I think it may well outweigh some of the trends we saw beforehand, where the top end could still be quite robust, because there's still going to be people who are wealthy, and, you know, those who have high incomes, you know, they will still, you know, there's still going to be enough of those around to keep fine dining, I think, going. It's probably not at the same level. I think it's going to be where the big hit will be, in that mass market casual dining, everyday eating out, you know. I think that's where people have learned now that they can perhaps cook at home and make food at home cheaper, and they've found a lot more different ways of eating and drinking during lockdown. So, which I suppose in a way flips it over to the fact that people might be more willing to spend, say, £10, £15, £20 in a bottle of wine at home rather than going to a pub or restaurant and spending 60, 80 quid for the same bottle. So it's going to be a balance sheet again, you know, but I think we have to be prepared for a particularly hard back of the year.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly in the north of England, where, as you know, I'm based, that there was always a sense that the typical clientele of some of the more upmarket restaurants, you know, the more expensive restaurants, were older people, if you like, and they did have more disposable income. And so there's an argument perhaps that they might be the least likely to want to venture out if they feel things are particularly safe.
Yeah. I think that's that. I mean, if you're looking at it purely from a wine perspective, you could say that all the independent retailers and potentially restaurants in the future as well, you know, home delivery and carry on, people being willing, as I said, you know, to spend a bit more money to drink at home rather than venturing out. So it doesn't necessarily mean to be complete doom and gloom for the wine trade, because you know, I still think that there's an opportunity there. And I think actually all those digital solutions that people came up with in e-commerce, and, you know, I think it's going to be even more pressure. And when the on-trade reopens and the competition is there, all the independents aren't going to have the market to themselves. So those who are the slickest in terms of marketing themselves and sending out emails and analysing their customer email lists and making sure that they are sending the right offers and promotions to the right people, I think all that's going to be really important over the next few months, being smarter in what you buy, as in putting your lists, but also smarter in how you then sell it to your mm-hmm. customers, you know, potential customers.
The focus of today's episode is obviously investment wine, and in particular, the kind of Italian wines that are beginning to emerge on the LiveX exchange. I'm talking to James Miles about that and about Italy's rapid growth in recent years. Have you ever been tempted to invest? Are you an investor in wine?
Well, Chief, as my job on my passport, and I have the word journalist, probably mean the answer to the question is no. Most of the wine I drink tends to, if it lasts a week in the house, is doing well. But so from a personal point of view, no. But actually, to be honest, I remember did a really interesting debate actually with James from LiveX, the Wine to Wine event in Verona in last November. And it was very interesting to hear from him then about how that whole secondary market for Italian wine has really taken off in the last few years. I mean, I suppose in response a little bit to France perhaps being a little bit too gung-ho with its prices for Bordeaux and Burgundy. And I think a lot of people who do invest, and I suppose this links us back to our previous conversation about what happens in the future. People who are looking to save a little bit more or not spend so much on wine, suddenly there are so many opportunities to get really fine wine from Italy that you know, if they're wine importers or the people who are normally pushing France their way, you know, if they can do the same and start, you know, doing things around things like Suave or, you know, all the regions of Italy, you know, Sicily, you know, the Puglia, everywhere in Italy has such great fine wines that possibly haven't really been part of that kind of fine wine conversation, or the collector conversation. I mean, obviously the big Tuscans and the sort of classic wines, but I think below that there's a really great opportunity now for importers to think about how they can push what you would classify as Italian fine wine, which potentially is going to be a lot more competitive than say from France or from California or the like.
I agree. I think that the market for Italian wines at that level is broadening, and I think it will only continue to broaden, and that will present some great opportunities for some what you might have previously called sort of mid-tier estates to really step up their game and craft a new space for themselves. It's going to be an interesting few years ahead, I think. And of course, we've noticed this week and last week that the top Bordeaux wines have been released on Premier from the 2019 vintage. They are almost 20-25% down, aren't they? So that perhaps suggests what merchants and producers think of the outlook going forward.
Yeah, and I think Bordeaux is slowly waking up to the reality of that. I mean, there's still some big Bordeaux chateaus who are managing to stick to their prices, and, you know, good luck to them. But I just think that that pendulum has swung. It's swung, and it's swinging more in the direction of those countries that can offer a wider range. And I suppose as people's perspectives or people's profile of fine wine widens a little bit more. I guess so with the knowledge, and I think actually there's a good opportunity for the trade here to really start talking up more Italian wines or alternatives to Bordeaux and Burgundy. It doesn't necessarily need to be from Italy, but it could be from, there's lots of different countries now that can offer a very viable alternative, and it's really for the importers to play their part here and look at what they've got in their portfolios, and you know they're going to need to be moving more wine and finding different ways of finding wine. So creating an alternative France fine wine list could be a great way of seeing the rest of 2020 out, with all due respect to the French.
Well, Italy is certainly a treasure chest of interesting grapes and wines, and I think if consumers and even merchants, to be fair, can get past the linguistic issues of some of these more obscure Italian wines, then there is so much to discover. But look, it's super warm. I will leave you to the rest of your afternoon. It's been great to talk to you, and we will pick up next week, no doubt, to see how things are progressing.
Yes, Chief, I'll go and work on my very very non-considerable tan, and I wish you all the best, Chief. See you next week, sir.
Yeah, indeed. Take care.
Yes, Chief.
Okay, good insight from Richard there, and I think there may be uncertain times ahead, but he certainly highlighted that sense of relief many of us are probably feeling at the moment. Safe or not, any step closer to normality must be a good thing. So, time for my conversation with James Miles of LiveX. Founded more than 20 years ago, the LiveX platform has been a real innovator in bringing trust and confidence to the fine wine market, and also for helping to iron out some of the trade's long-standing inefficiencies. Here's James. Let's take a listen.
James Miles, thank you very much for joining me on the Italian Job podcast. I'm delighted you can be here. I hope you're well.
I'm really, really pleased to be here. I'm incredibly well, thank you.
Marvellous, excellent. I want to talk about the market for Italian wines, particularly in relation to investment grade wines, of course. And I want to talk a little bit about LiveX and what trading conditions might be like at the moment. But perhaps you can introduce LiveX for anyone that isn't familiar with the business.
Sure. I mean, LiveX is a marketplace for the wine trade. So we don't deal with producers or the consumer. We're a middleman to the middleman, if you like. And we really help our merchants to perform three tasks. Firstly, to price and value wines. We have a big database of prices and data, and write a lot of content and insight around that data. So we help inform merchants about what's going on in the market. As most marketplaces do, we also bring together a large number of different players in one place. So merchants can find a big marketplace for their products, both to find wines that they don't have in stock or to sell wines at perhaps better prices than they can through their existing channels through our marketplace. And the third thing that we really do is we help them to fulfill those transactions. So we've got a big logistics network around the world which helps merchants to fulfill their transactions. So that those are our three primary roles in the market.
Uh-huh. And I suppose the data that you have available through your monitoring of these various activities probably positions LiveX quite well, doesn't it, in terms of spotting trends and identifying which wines can deliver some value for investors. Is that right?
Yeah. So we, you know, initially LiveX was very much inspired. I mean, Justin Gibbs and I, who founded the business, were both from a financial markets background. So we understood what good market data and information could do for a market and the value of providing that information. So from the very earliest point, we've been collecting huge amounts of data, and which now we've now got hundreds of millions of data points, principally prices. A lot of it comes from transactions and orders on LiveX's platform, but we also collect market data from our merchants and from auctions and really from wherever we can get it. Mm. And since about 2001, we've been publishing various indices, starting with the LiveX 100 index, which really seeks to track the most sought after wines in the world and to measure their prices. But we also have prices on now on hundreds of thousands of different wines, and we spend a lot of time measuring and, you know, tracking their performance. Absolutely. So that's a core part of what we do.
And I suppose with that in mind, you must have witnessed the gradual emergence of Italian wines and perhaps initially Tuscan wines. Can you perhaps talk about this trend and this growth that Italy is seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a fascinating... We've always traded Italian wines, but the breadth and depth and importance of Italian wines has really increased in the last 10 or so years. I mean, I think certainly 10 years ago, when we thought about fine wines, we were principally talking about the top Bordeaux wines. I mean, Bordeaux accounted for, you know, 95% of the trade that we did on our platform. We did a lot of trade in the first growths, for example. And after the Bordeaux bubble burst in sort of 2011, 2012, and a lot of Bordeaux wines became incredibly expensive, I think there was a move in the market to seek out sort of lower entry level fine wines. And I think all regions have benefited from that. But certainly Italy has been a big beneficiary. I mean, I think if you look in 2010, Italy probably accounted for 1% of our trade on LiveX. And today it's much closer to 15%. So that's pretty dramatic growth in what's been a growing market.
Uh-huh. I suppose the idea of a bubble bursting and you know, investors being sort of stuck with wines that perhaps they've paid more for than you know, they're then worth at the time, brings me to this idea of what the concepts of value are. I suppose the history of investing in wine is kind of, as you say, built around the 1855 classification in Bordeaux. We've got the first growths and the second growths really occupying the top spaces. But if we look at those kind of wines and those kind of wineries and how they produce their wines, we can probably find similarities, can't we, with Tuscany and the idea of Cabernet and Merlot-based blends and the kind of aristocratic prestige of the, you know, the founding families, if you like.
Yeah, I think it's an intriguing question. I mean, a question I often ask myself is, you know, why is it that France established this sort of preeminence in fine wine? I mean, actually, Italy has a much older history. I think the wine was being produced in Italy 600 years plus before it arrived in France. And I think the reason for that is severalfold. Firstly, Bordeaux, of course, was part of the English kingdom for 300 years. So, and via its seaports on the Gironde, had easy access to international markets in a way that Italy didn't. But also the sense of terroir, which is an ancient concept in France. Also, this idea that wines could be produced in very different styles and attract very different prices depending on their location and their soil types and their aspect. This is a uniquely French concept, which I think allowed French producers to build a sense of premium around their wines. And as you say, I mean, that's something that certainly in Bordeaux dates back to 1855, but in Burgundy, the cru concept is much, much older than that. So I think there was a sense of premium in France, you know, 300 or 400 years ago. And that's really quite a new concept. I mean, I guess the access they had to international markets, particularly the English market, where wine could be, was seen more as a premium product. And, you know, certainly in the UK, was drunk by the aristocracy in its early form. It meant really that you know, European growers could achieve much, much higher prices in those international markets. And those sort of international markets didn't really present themselves to Italian growers really until the big migrations of the Italian population in the 20th century, both across Europe and particularly the United States, where which of course led to a proliferation of Italian restaurants across the world and Italian wine, and sort of introduced Italian wine to the four corners of the world. But I think that the notion of terroir, as you suggested, didn't really occur until after the war, and not really until the 60s, when you've got Sassicaia and the Antinori family starting to produce Bordeaux blends and really buck the trend and start to promote this concept of terroir and grower wines in Italy. And that was really quite a new revolutionary concept. I mean, you know, the notion of cruz doesn't really even exist in Italy, you know, prior to the last 20 or 30 years. So it's the idea of fine wine is a much more modern idea in the Italian market, where I think historically wine was seen not as a premium thing, but as just as food, as one Italian friend of mine described it. You know, the idea that wine could be something that would be traded in or speculated in or bought as a luxury item is a very, very new concept in Italy, whereas it's a much older concept in France.
Yeah, I think, as you say, that immediate post-war period has been very important for the development of a number of different Italian wine regions. And we can look at the famous wines of Piedmont, those from Barolo and Barbaresco, and we can look at how globally famous they are now. And of course, if we consider that back in the early 60s or 50s and 60s, they were still very much just local village wines. And as you say, it is this Italian diaspora that have gone to America, gone to Australia, and it's demand for those wines, I think, that has fueled a lot of the growth in those places.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, my early memories of Italian wine, going to the local Italian restaurant with Chianti in a basket. I mean, you know, that's a sort of, you know, that would be reasonably anathema to Italians now, but that was very much how we in the international world sort of saw Italian wines, wasn't it? And that's not actually, well, I'm 50, so when we're talking, you know, 30, 40 years ago, but there has been a massive revolution in that period of time, for sure.
I'm nervous about mentioning scores because I appreciate it is such a minefield, but they are crucial, aren't they, to the world of investment wines? And am I right in saying that really it is those handful of American critics that have really brought Italian wines up to the same level as some of the premium wines from Bordeaux and Burgundy?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the critics have been absolutely instrumental in promoting Italian wines around the world and putting them into the same conversations as the great wines of France. You know, and I suppose they've done the same with Californian wines and Australian wines. So yes, I think the critics have played an incredibly important part. James Suckling spent a long time living in Tuscany, for example. Monica Lana, the wine advocate, is important. Antonio Galloni, who is of Italian descent. Clearly, all these guys have played a really instrumental part of making Italian wines part of the mainstream. That's absolutely true. Yeah, you're completely correct in saying that.
Okay, so let's just do a little bit of name dropping if we can. We've mentioned Sassicaia and their, perhaps their first vintage back in 1968. Can you talk us through some of the wines that are popular on Livex?
Yeah,
Tignanello, sure. Presumably, is one.
Sure. So, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think if one looks at the trade on Livex, you know, it's still the names that dominate are still the Super Tuscan, Sassicaia, Tignanello, Ornellaia, Musetto, Salaia. Those are all still incredibly important You know, they're all made in pretty big quantities and they're sold at high prices. So you'd expect that. But I'd say 10 years ago, that was the market for Italian wines on LiveX. And if we were selling 25 names, let's just say, on LiveX 10 years ago, we're now selling, in 2019, we sold 750 to 800 different labels. And this year, we're already at close to that number. So, you know, and so there's been a, we're not just, we're selling everything really from Sassicaia, Montfortino, from Giacosa at £7,000 a case to really quite low price wines at maybe 5-10 euros a bottle. So the, you know, I think we've seen this huge proliferation. But the big trade names are the obvious names, you know, the top Super Tuscans, the top names from Barolo, from Brunello. Those are the names that still dominate trade on the platform.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that makes the idea of terroir very interesting again, as you said earlier. You know, the fact that Barolo and Barbaresco are becoming more popular and demand is rising for not just the current vintages but also back vintages of some of these wines, when their prestige is built around the notion of the single vineyard and very low production, it does perhaps hint that demand for Italian wines might grow beyond those regions in the future. And I suppose that also inspires me to ask, what's next? And how do you avoid another little bubble? How do you avoid rapid inflation of prices for some of these wines that do have quite short histories and levels of provenance?
Yes, I think that's going to be quite difficult, isn't it? I mean, particularly for some of these, for some of the Barolos. You know, I mean, actually, if one looks at the trade on LiveX this year, we've seen massive growth in trade in the wines from Piedmont. I mean, they're now nearly half of all Italian trade, having been 20 to 30% last year. So I think that trend is happening. And prices of Barolo are outpacing, or price increases of Barolo are outpacing Tuscan wines exponentially. You know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this is the point. You know, some of the wines in Tuscany are made in Bordeaux type numbers, you know, 10, 20,000 cases production. Whereas in Piedmont, as you know, the production levels are so much smaller, much more along Burgundian lines. You know, 1,000 cases is a decent production. And clearly the kind of demand that you're seeing for these wines, the only way that one can really juggle the disparity between between supply and demand is through price. So we are seeing some rapid increases in prices for Barolo wines. As I say, Montfortino is now £7,000 a case. So, you know, that's getting up to the sort of prices of Le Fleur and Cheval Blanc, and actually exceeding those sort of levels. So these are, but to put that into some context, I mean, you know, DRC is now £10,000-£15,000 a bottle. So it's still, relative to Burgundy, a reasonably cheap entry point. And, you know, if the Super Tuscans are sort of 1,800 quid, a first growth is kind of £4,000. So relative to Bordeaux and Burgundy, Tuscany and Piedmont still at relatively good value.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the immediate future is always going to be built around red wine, isn't it? Obviously, the ageability of red wines over white wines has meant that there's more sense in trading these kind of wines. But is it possible that white wines could emerge in this world?
Yeah, we do certainly trade them. But as you say, the age worthiness, or the lack of age worthy, or aging potential really on the white side just creates fewer trading opportunities if you think about it. You know, most white wines aren't really appearing on the secondary market because they're just being drunk, whereas, you know, a top Barolo can last 30, 40, 50 years. So there's lots of opportunity for those to trade in the secondary market, whereas you wouldn't be expecting white wines to be lasting that long. It's not to say that white wines aren't trading on LiveX, it's just that they're not trading in the same kind of quantities as the reds. So, and I suspect, I don't see that changing. I don't think that's something that's going to, going to change.
And in terms of sort of thinking about the customer base for Italian wines in particular through your platform, how many do you think are really looking at these kind of wines as investments, and how many are just seeking to source unusual and rare and appreciated wines perhaps for consumption?
Well, I've always thought that, you know, investment in wine is a minority sport. Those people who are purely interested in it for investment. I mean, you know, the vast majority of collectors are interested in these wines to drink. You know, clearly they want to get them at they want to feel like they're going to go up in price because they need to justify buying these wines to their wives, for example, and to be able to say, well, look, you know, my cellar's gone up in price by a lot, sort of slightly justifies their extravagance. And I think that's true of art. It's true of buying old cars or furniture or whatever, is that while you love these things and you want to enjoy them, they are collectible. So it is important that they do, you know, that you can see them trading in a secondary market like LiveX at these high prices, and that over time they do appreciate in value. Which I suppose justifies the fact that you're having to cellar these wines in many cases for 10 or 20 years before you can actually enjoy them. So the idea that they're going to be cheaper today than they are tomorrow is an important underpinning to the way the fine wine market works.
And I suppose with that, let's finish with some discussion of what conditions are like at the moment. I mean, obviously it's been a very difficult situation around the world for the last few months, and it's probably likely to continue. But is the fine wine market reasonably bulletproof over the very long term, at least? Are investors seeking to move money into this asset class?
Well, I think it's proved to be robust during the crisis because it's predominantly online to a large extent, you know. So that's certainly been helpful. And in most places around the world, wine is seen as an essential product. It's seen as part of the food supply system. So the supply chain has remained open throughout the process. Clearly, there have been big challenges for those companies that sell into the hospitality sector, to restaurants and hotels. But actually, in the fine wine space, that's a relatively minority sport. Most wines are traded actually between merchants or to the collector. So that trade has continued. And that, if we have seen a trend, it's to slightly smaller trade sizes, to slightly lower value wines than perhaps we're used to. But the volumes have remained actually really quite robust. I mean, as far as Italy is concerned, we've seen a big increase in Italian trade on LiveX in the first quarter of this year. And a big part of that is that the Italian trade, who represents an increasingly important part of our customer base, had their two sources, predominantly sources of demand, turned off. The first being tourism, the second being hotels and restaurants, which are obviously closely interlinked. So a lot of them look to LiveX as a new route to market, a way. So they've been increasing their sales in the international market to make up for the lost demand in their traditional sectors. So that's been an important part of why trading in Italian wines really increased. And the second part of that story is, of course, that there are American tariffs on European wines, largely linked to a dispute around aircraft manufacturing, and it's a dispute between Airbus and Boeing. And actually, Italy isn't part of the Airbus consortium. And so Italy has been exempted, Italian wine has been exempted from those American 25% tariffs on still wine. And that's really, really benefited the Italian market. So, you know, Italy's share of trade on Livex has kind of increased, partially because of the crisis and partially because of this anomaly around US tariffs and the fact that, you know, America has always been a very, very important market for Italian wines anyway. But the fact that it's also got this 25% price advantage now has meant that they have built a lot of market share on the back of that. So those two things have been really, really important.
Uh-huh. Brilliant. And so finally, let's just close. Are you allowed to make some predictions or some suggestions for people who might be looking to dabble in Italian wine for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there are a few things. You can expect that the market's going to continue to broaden, I think, going to continue to fragment away from France. And I think that Italy will be a beneficiary of that. I think within Italy, given the scarcity, the supply issues that we talked about, and the disparity between demand and supply, which I think is going to continue for some time. So even though Piedmont, you might be thinking it looks pretty expensive, you know, I remember thinking this about Burgundy 4 or 5 years ago. And so my sense would be that the wines of Barolo will continue to outpace Tuscan wines because of that problem. And that trend will probably persist for much longer than seems rational, which is tends to quite often be the case. So yes, I see Italian wines continue to do well. And I think within Italy, Piedmont is going to outpace, you know, Tuscany and the other regions, purely because the wines have built up this fantastic reputation amongst collectors, and they're made in very, very small quantities. So I suspect that the basic laws of economics suggest that they're going to do well.
Excellent. James Miles of Livex, thank you very much for being on the Italian Job podcast.
Paul, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was James Miles of Livex with plenty of interesting points about Italy and, of course, about the way Livex works and how their business has perhaps evolved over the years. Economic uncertainty or not, I think this is a great period for fine wine collectors and traders and drinkers, of course. The seemingly endless foundation of exceptional wine out there, combined with an expansion of the kind of wines that are considered suitable for trading, really represents a real cultural shift in the way customers value wine. And I think this ultimately must be good for diversity. As I said earlier, it really should encourage the pursuit of premium winemaking, regardless of how historically prestigious a region or a country's wines are. So that is really something to keep an eye out for, and in general, great news for Italy. Okay, that is all we've got time for today. I want to say a big thank you to Richard and James for their thoughts and participation. Hopefully you, the listener, have enjoyed it as much as I have. And of course, you will be back for the next one. Please feel free to subscribe to The Italian Job on Apple or Spotify. And of course, share on social media. That's always very helpful. If you wish to reach out to me, I'm not hard to find. I'm Paul Caputo, and you can read more on vinorandom.com. That's it then. Until next time, have fun, stay safe, drink Italian wine, and ci sentiamo presto. Ciao.